The ministry of Jesus was noted for his consistent promotion of the kingdom of God, or reign of God. And to prove that he was a special messenger sent by God to proclaim or prophesy this message, his preaching was frequently punctuated with a wide range of miracles. These healings and exorcisms attracted the attention of the religious leaders of the day. And in particular, groups of Pharisees began to follow him and examine the validity of these miraculous claims. Of course, the Pharisees represented all those who disbelieved, especially those who viewed Jesus as a competitor for the loyalty and support of the Jewish people living in the Galilee region. Sensing their ulterior motives, Jesus says to the Pharisees, "All who have come before me are thieves and robbers, but the sheep have not listened to them. I am the door. Whoever enters through me will be saved from the present distress. They will come in and go out and find pasture. The thief comes only to steal and to kill and to destroy. But I have come that they may have life and have life to the full." That's John 10:8-10. Now this statement by Jesus refers back to Israel's distant and recent history of oppression, subjugation, and punishment. Successive empires had controlled Israel, and even at times attempted to eliminate the worship of Yahweh altogether among the Jewish people. And at this time, the time of Jesus, it was obviously the Romans who dominated the populations of Israel and Judah. And life was harsh and restrictive. And to ease the suffering of the people, numerous religious figures, with obvious reference to the Pharisees, had risen up to claim relief to the people in the name of God. They had promised either victory against the Romans or God's divine intervention in their lives to bring them more joy, more prosperity, and more freedom. And all had failed. All had proven to be thieves and robbers of people's hopes and expectations for deliverance. They had stolen and destroyed the confidence that people had in their God and their religious system. And it is in this context that Jesus says he will not fail to deliver the people. He will fulfill their hopes and desires, and he will be, one way or another, victorious against Israel's enemies. He, and he alone, is the Good Shepherd, and he says his followers recognize him as such. Jesus had come to bring abundant life to everyone who joined his cause. But what kind of life was he referring to? Was it life today, in his time? Was it a future life of some kind? Whatever it was, it could only be valid if it was different from the life they already had. And it must raise these people who heard him out of their present circumstances. There are basically three Greek words in the scriptures used to describe life. The first one is bios, and that refers to the physical body, the flesh, that which covers the bones and is permeated with blood. The English word biology comes from bios. In Luke 21:4, after Jesus saw the pittance that the self-righteous rich people placed in the offering box, he saw a poor widow put in 2 small copper coins. And he praised her actions to the disciples, saying, "All these people gave their gifts out of their wealth, but she, out of her poverty, put in all she had to sustain life." And the life there is the Greek word bios. Secondly is the Greek word psuche, which could be translated as soul life. It refers to the psychological life of the human mind, the human emotion and will. The English word psychology comes from psuche. Psuche is who we are rather than what we are made of. It is our personality. You could say it is our being, our soul. Psuche also has a broader meaning to include the breath of life. That is the vital force inside of us that animates and brings to life the flesh, the bios. In Matthew 10:39, Jesus said, "Whoever finds his life will lose it, and whoever loses their life for my sake will find it." And he wasn't referring to suicide. He wasn't referring to those that physically die. Those who surrender their will, their personality, their independent soul will supersede the life of the bios and transform their psyche. It's the word psyche that Jesus was referring to. That's what we give up. Thirdly, the Greek word for life that we refer to in John 10, where Jesus said that he had come to bring abundant life, is the Greek word zoe. Zoe is the state of one who is possessed of full vitality, of absolute fullness of life, all that life can be, a life active and vigorous, devoted to God. In the Greco-Roman world, it was believed that all humans were born, less than ideal, less than perfect. So it was one's life work to become fully perfect, to become fully human. And this perfection of humanity was what Jesus was offering. What was missing, according to the followers of Jesus, was not a perfect physique, not a perfect education, as the Greeks sought, but it was a perfect spirit, a higher life that was joined to and energized by the divine. By our physical birth, we possess only the physical life, the bios, and the soul life, the psuche. No one possessed the divine life, the zoe life, when they were born. It's something that you had to achieve and connect to later on. But when we follow Jesus as our example, like an older brother, like a shepherd guide who leads us through the gate or through the door, upwards to a higher life, then Jesus connects us to zoe life. And that divine life allows us to, and this is the important part of it, it allows us to supersede the limitations of the bios and the psuche life. One that is motivated and driven by more than the desires of the flesh for comfort, for ego gratification and self-fulfillment. And there were plenty false messiahs promising liberty to the bios life of the Jewish people, offering hope of a political or military victory against the Roman oppressors. And there were plenty teachers of the law, dangling the promise of an intellectual escape from the drudgery of daily life in Galilee by appealing to the psyche within. But Jesus was announcing that only he could connect his followers to a higher life, a divine life, a zoe life, to raise people out of the way of thinking and living that always left people eventually feeling dead inside and ultimately without hope. So what is it about the divine life that makes us any different than we were before? What is it about the divine life that makes us more than flesh and soul? Since there's no feeling or sensation connected with gaining Zoe life, we must look to changing characteristics in the life of an individual to identify that we are spiritually activated, spiritually maturing as a result of God in us. So there's a whole range of characteristics that we could point to, but I want to just list five. First of all, we will be suffused with faith and confidence and joy even in times of trouble, distress, fear, and uncertainty. You may never have lived at a time when uncertainty, fear, and distress were common, but if you could imagine what such a time might be like, a Christian, one connected to Zoe life, ought to have a faith and a confidence in those times. I'm sure we're all familiar with the words to old hymns, such as, "It is well with my soul," or "Blessed assurance," "Leaning on the everlasting arms," "Standing on the promises," and "Who could forget, a mighty fortress is our God." These traditional classic hymns are songs that express this confidence, this joy, this celebration, and assurance that Christians ought to have because of their belief that there is a higher power that we are both connected to and who knows us and cares for us. Secondly, we will overflow with generosity, partly because we understand that life is more than flesh and soul, and partly because we're imbued with the gracious and giving nature of God. When we have Zoe life, we don't grasp greedily for everything we can get. Zoe life is not greedy. Zoe life causes us to actually be happier when giving rather than receiving. But it goes beyond that. We actively search for ways to enrich, encourage, and enliven others with whatever gifts and resources we have at our disposal. Zoe life can even be expressed self-sacrificially at times. In other words, we don't just give because we have lots to give. We give because there's a lot of need in addition to our own. Thirdly, we become increasingly peacemakers. It's very easy to fake peace by avoidance. That is, acknowledging the problem but refusing to act, either out of fear or we just don't care. Or out of insincerity, that is, pretending that there's no conflict to address and hoping it just goes away. Zoe life causes us to take the hard road of facing injustice, engaging in difficult reconciliation, and initiating resolutions to struggles that may even be many years old. Furthermore, our demeanor becomes peaceful and peaceable, not quick to anger, believing the best of people until proven otherwise, and genuinely interested in the welfare of others. Fourthly, we will love unconditionally. You don't naturally want to love those who oppose us and offend us. In my bios, that is my flesh, and in my psyche, I like those who like me and who are good to me. I love people who can benefit me in some way. With Zoe life in me, I am able to grow to love those who can do nothing for me. The homeless, the defenseless, the poor widow, the orphaned, the sick, and the weak. Loving unconditionally simply means not getting anything back in response to what we have given over and over and over again, repeatedly and consistently. It also means that love is a choice, not a response. So your actions don't affect my choice to love you. And it's easy to see when we think of loving unconditionally a child. But it goes beyond those in our own family and those that we particularly know and care about. This is a divine love that accepted us with all our faults and failings and did not condemn us because through Jesus we connected to Zoe life. Fifth, we will demonstrate a sincere humility, not thinking more highly of our own greatness than we ought. Ego belongs with the bios and the psyche, with the flesh and the soul. Zoe life has no ego. The Apostle Paul, in his exhortation to the Romans, said, "Do not be conformed to the ways of the world." In other words, to the ways of the bios and the psyche. Don't limit your life to only those lower elements of life. He urged people to be transformed by the renewing of their minds that could only take place by the activity of Zoe life in them. And characteristic of this spiritual and mental transformation would be for his followers to not think more highly of themselves than they ought, considering how weak and frail the bios and the psyche are. That's Romans 12:3. Paul wanted Christians to find confidence in a life that came from a divine source. So back to the original passage, Jesus said, and I'm paraphrasing a little bit here, "The religious thief comes to steal your spiritual freedom and to kill your hopes for a higher life and to destroy your relationship and connection with your Creator. But I have come that they may have Zoe life and have it to the full, today and tomorrow." The word religion comes from the old Latin religare, which means to tie up or to bind. It implies a binding of oneself to a set code of belief, ritual, and conduct, especially in response to a fear of the supernatural. Does that really sound like the kind of life that Jesus came to connect us to? Religion? Institutional religion always seems to result in the death of self. Not inevitably, but it consistently ends up that way because we're asked to give up sovereignty of our life, not really to God, but to religious gurus and bishops and pastors and preachers. Jesus called on people to bypass the priests and the teachers of the law, to know the Heavenly Father as he knew him. After the death of Jesus, the veil of the temple was said to tear in half as a removal of barriers between us and God. And that's what Zoe life is all about. Equal access to a higher, fuller, abundant, divine life for all people, all races, all genders, all ages, all backgrounds. And we will never be forced to enjoy this higher Zoe life. We're simply invited to participate now and forever.